day 61, Will here on the Canadian Barrens. Had a very violent storm last night. The wind was at least about 70 miles an hour. It was vibrating really violently. I put the hurricane flaps out.
That's Minnesota explorer Will Steger on his recent solo voyage into the barren lands of northern Canada. What did he learn this time about climate change near the Arctic Circle? I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Welcome to this special one-hour edition of ClimateCast. He's seen sea ice in the Arctic vanish. He's trekked across Antarctic ice sheets that have now disintegrated into the ocean. Now he's back from a two-month solo journey into the barren lands in northern Canada, and he joins us here in the relative warmth and comfort of the NPR studios this morning. Will Steger, welcome to the Weather Lab. It's good to see you again.
Good to be here, Paul. Thank you.
And we want to hear from you this hour. What do you want to know about what Will has seen in his journeys? Call us at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828 or tweet me at NPR Weather with your questions and comments, hashtag ClimateCast. So let's start here. Will, why this trip?
Well, I've been doing these spring trips the last 6-7 years, and mainly local trips north of Ontario. So I decided to up the ante, and I've traveled in the Barrens a lot. I really have a fascination and a love for that beauty and that subtle beauty of that area. So I decided to take a really long, it actually was going to be a 1,000-mile trip by canoe sled. And the canoe sled is a canoe with runners, and I rely mainly on the weather thawing, and then when it freezes, you have a solid surface, so it's really easy to pull it. And I travel at breakup as the rivers are breaking up, but this spring was a big surprise.
And I was going to ask you about that. Like all of us this spring, you ran into some late wintry weather to start your trip, right? Tell us about the first month or so.
Well, you know, for 2 months, it never did break up in the north. I left on March 20th. I didn't see our first temperatures above zero till the 25th of May. And it was one of the coldest springs on record up there.
Yes.
Very strong, continual northwest winds. Like the weather patterns were stalled, snow and storms. And so it ended up to being a long, almost a 600-mile portage for me. I was hauling this canoe over snow.
Yeah.
But it was still a good trip. I got in very good shape, but it was totally different than what I thought it was going to be.
And you were like the rest of us. That Hudson Bay low, that big upper-level low that was parked over Hudson Bay, I was talking about that for weeks during April. We had, of course, the big Dayton's Monkey blizzard here in mid-April. So that was the same weather pattern that we experienced here. Will, paint a picture for us. What does it look like in the Canadian Barrens?
Barrens are like, so that's a barren lands north of the boreal forest, east of Hudson, or west of Hudson Bay. And it's almost an extension of the Great Plains. There's no trees. It's pretty low relief. And I had a lot of whiteouts over half the time. The whiteout is like traveling, basically you're traveling in a cloud. You can't really see. There's no size.
Do you just have to hunker down then, or do you keep going?
Just keep going. I'm used to traveling in these conditions. And they were so continual that, you know, I had to travel with them. But so it's very hard to navigate in this area. It's very difficult to tell where you are. I use the GPS a lot. And I was also on rivers for about probably 350 miles that were frozen. But I still had to be able to read the ice to know where to be. So it was very tricky that way. But it's a very subtle beauty. I was in the middle of the great caribou migration for almost a week. You know, I saw thousands and thousands of caribou. I'd wake up in the morning and outside my tent there'd be caribou sleeping and caribou all over. Then muskox, huge animals that for some reason had a black tent which would absorb the energy from the mm-hmm. sun. So it was really warm. But the muskox were attracted to this black tent. I must have thought it was a fellow companion or a rock.
Right.
But they would camp out right by my tent. And it was very unusual waking up to see these kind of like a prehistoric animal the size of a Volkswagen outside my tent door.
Nice travel partners. I think that was a good omen for you.
Yeah, it was very good.
You know, we heard about the storms you encountered. We heard a clip up at the top of the show, but you also had some other surprises on this trip, speaking of animals. Listen to this clip from your NPR interview with Phil Picardi, and then let's talk about it on the other side.
I did have a run-in with a grizzly about 10 days ago, the largest grizzly bear I've ever seen. It came for me, and I not carrying a rifle here, and that was
pretty incredible experience.
So how'd you get out of that one?
Well, I was fortunate in a way, but I carry these, what's called a bear banger. It's a device. It's a launched by a kind of a pen-sized launcher. It's like a fireworks. It's a little rocket that shoots and then explodes.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I mean, in theory, that is supposed to scare them away. It took three of these before I got its attention. And you have to be very careful in launching these, because if you overshoot the bear, you'll scare the bear into you. But finally, when the bear got close, I bounced one off its chest and exploded in its face. That was my last shot, actually.
Wow.
And then it stopped, and it was not afraid. It weighed its decision. It kind of paced back and forth. And it was an older bear, so I think it had, you know, it understood what a human being was. So it made the wise decision, I think, for me. It wandered off into the brush again. And it had a very happy ending for me, because I was totally out of negotiation material at that point.
Will Steger is our guest, talking about his recent trip to the Canadian Barrens. And if you have a question for Will, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also tweet me at MPR Weather. So, Will, we've talked before about your commitment and observations on climate change. What was the climate connection for you with this trip?
Well, it was again, see what the present climate was at that time, which was very unusual. It was really extreme. I wanted to be in touch with the migration and the animals to see what the effect on that. And it's just keeping my pulse continually on the Arctic. What I found is the caribou migration is really quite variable. It's quite extreme. It's not always in the same place as it always was. The muskox, these huge animals, they're almost prehistoric, they're the size of buffalo, they're doing real well because of the increase of vegetation, brush, a little bit of brush appearing. And the geese, hundreds of thousands of geese were up there. But it was mainly to keep my pulse on what's happening in the Arctic, to be current. And also for personal, it was just great to get 70 days alone, get away from technology and politics, and come back very clear-headed and ready to jump in and start working on the climate again.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that, because I sort of have, not to the Will Steger extent, but that desire to seek some solitude. I feel a little inadequate here. I'm doing a four-day Boundary Waters solo in a couple of weeks. You can imagine I get a lot of human contact at this job, so I crave that solitude too once in a while. But is that one of the reasons why you do what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I've traveled on expeditions. I've traveled a lot when I was younger with a partner, and that works out real well. And then I had a career of 25 years of international expeditions, six people, very complicated, involved lots of money and sponsorships. But the other type of travel of solo that I've done throughout my life is very appealing, especially right now, because I don't need a sponsor. And with a lot of preparation, I can just drop out and then come right back in. But the need for solitude, I mean, I'm social. I've got lots of friends. I really like our community down here. But I think everybody needs to be alone at certain times. But I'm totally comfortable with myself alone. But I also like to test my limits a little bit. And that's why I travel on thin ice. And I feel I'm very safe, but I really have to be in that moment, which is really, I think, the real space to be in. And it's a great personal space. So all around, it's a good retreat. Like your 4-day, I mean, the fact that you can get 4 days off, that's a very great thing to do. And I think we all need that, especially now when things are so taxing and technology, politics, and so forth. It's great to get away and come back fresh.
Will, we've got some callers that are interested in chatting with you. Do you mind taking a couple
of
questions?
Sure, of course. Thank you.
Let's go to Marty in northern Wisconsin. Good morning, Marty. What's your question for Will Steger?
Hello, good morning. Will, I know you have had some very poignant messages from the Inuit people and Native people who are in that part of the world, and their observations about what is happening with global climate change. Can you, I hate to bring this down because these are heartbreaking things, but please tell us what they're saying, if you would. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. And yeah, well, of course, the entire Arctic and polar environment is changing, and that along is changing the culture up there. Like I said, the caribou migration A lot of these far northern communities, the Athabascans, and the Inuit, they rely on the hunting of these caribou for their year's worth of meat, and the caribou just is not showing up, or the population has dwindled or disappeared. You're seeing more vegetation, more wildlife that has never been seen up there. The Inuit are adapting as good as they can. They're fishing more. The ice, of course, is at least a couple months less of ice. You know, for an Inuit, who are marine people, but they live on the they hunt on the ocean when it's frozen. That's totally changing. So it's and they're affected probably 3-4 times more than we are, because what's happening there, of course, is we're losing the ice and the snow, and when the ice and snow disappears, the radiation of the sun absorbs on the land and on the open water. So global warming and climate change is really magnified up there because of that. And that's why we saw the first major changes, in, which I experienced in the 90s and at the turn of the century. And now, of course, at our latitude, we're all familiar with the extremes that we witness almost from month to month, from droughts. It can be a drought, and then all of a sudden you have floods and fires. And you can look around the states and around the world. It's pretty obvious right now. So the climate change now is affecting everybody.
Well, those changes that you observed in the Arctic, I'm curious about your journey to climate change. Was it that started you, or was it something else?
Well, you know, I taught climate change, global warming, when I taught a school teacher in the late 60s. I taught it back then. So I was a science teacher. I've kept weather records since I was 8 years old. And this was something, ocean currents and weather was astronomy were of innate interest to myself, which I always applied on expeditions. So I was aware of that, and I would always read the journals and keep up with the sciences. And I followed it even in the early 80s. I was aware of what was happening, but we were starting to look for the signal, that the first early sign, in other words, which I started seeing in the Arctic in the 80s, which became pronounced in the 90s when we start losing the sea ice. And losing the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean has actually changed, as you know, the ocean currents and their weather currents, which probably gave me the really cold weather this year that we're experiencing. And I've had a career of almost 57 years now in the Arctic, and I've seen it in the first 25 years of my life, travel up there. I saw it as it was a normal cold. I met prospectors from the gold rush of 1898 when I was a young kid. I mean, I date back that far. And then living intuitively and on my instincts, I mean, it's different of being in an environment and not being paying attention, but I rely on my instincts and my sixth sense to stay alive. Observing the environment as a native person, I start seeing these changes. And then I saw the changes, how it affect the culture and the animals. And I just couldn't see. I can't believe, looking back, what I've all seen in just 1 year. And it's just quite remarkable what's happening. We just got a report that just came out. I think it was in the Tribune. I saw it yesterday in the Washington Post about Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And now right. Everything's changing.
Well, that the rate of sea ice is increasing, melt three times faster in the last 25 years or so, which could be a signal of things to come. Let's take another phone call. James in Rochester, good morning. What's your question for Will Steger this morning?
Well, it was kind of answered somewhat with his, he talked a little bit about the Inuit. I've just been rereading Farley Mowat's book, People of the Deer, mm-hmm. and wondered how the inland Inuit are faring at all. And are there any of them left, or are they just clustered around the Hudson's Bay area itself now?
Yeah, there's a large community. And actually, I was traveling in the Barrens and the inland Inuit called caribou Inuit, because they relied totally on caribou, and they evolved in the interior. So even in their religion and ceremonies and that, there's nothing about seals. The seal is the staple of all the Inuit, but the caribou Inuit rely on caribou. And, of course, the migration is really spotty. A lot of the caribou Inuit are in Baker Lake. This was actually my destination, but because of the heavy snow, I was not unable to make that community. There's probably about 1,500 people there. And then the rest of the caribou Inuit, the majority of them are in Hudson Bay. Because they have snowmobiles, that's a real advantage to them. If the caribou migrate near the town, within 300 miles, they can still hunt. But there is still a large population of the caribou Inuit. Some of them actually make their living on mines, but they're still struggling in our employment because they were moved as a nomadic life in the late 50s into a community life, which was a huge change. But they're still there, and I know a lot of the people there in that community, but and they're still able to make a living and mainly through jobs and that, but caribou is still their main source of food.
Will, you've been at this for a long time with these expeditions. I know a lot of us are pretty impressed and awed by the physical stress of what you must do. Let's go to Lisa in St. Paul, because I think she's got a question for you about that. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Hi, Will. I've known Will for more than 25 years, and my son Gavin and I have been up in Ely at his amazing estate, and I was very, very impressed to know that Will was going to do another solo trip. And I love it that he used it to highlight what's going on in the world. So, Will, I'm wondering, do you have in your sights another solo trip? Where and why?
Good hearing from you, Lisa. And, yeah, of course. I mean, I actually left my canoe where I ended my trip, way in the Barrens. It's hard to get a canoe sled into that area. So I'll be going back next April to that spot, and then I'll be going straight north to the Arctic Ocean, about 500 miles through very extreme area, and area that's been very rarely traveled. I'll end up on the Arctic Ocean and then at the Inuit community of Cambridge Bay, where I have a number of friends. So as always, I'll be doing another expedition, and I'll be doing the same thing, calling in so people can watch that next spring or listen to it if they want to.
Will, you and I have spoken at some of the same events in the past few years. I was awestruck by the photographs you showed of those Larsen ice shelves in Antarctica that you crossed by dog sled that have since completely collapsed. Is that one of the most striking climate changes you've witnessed?
I would have to say so. I mean, the Larsen ice shelf on the Antarctic Peninsula, it took us 14 days to cross that in 1990. And when we landed on the Larsen A ice shelf, a little smaller ice, but when we landed, we saw these ice shelves. It was the largest land feature I've ever seen in my life. And mm-hmm. I equated that to be permanent. And then in March, early March of 2002, I remember I was up in Ely, I was reading the Minneapolis Tribune about the 10th page. There was an article that said, Larsen B ice shelf disintegrates, and it really floored me. I knew there was issues with the Larsen B, but no one realized that an ice shelf of this size could just break up or almost literally overnight or within a month period. That's what actually was my motivation for forming the nonprofit Climate Generation, because I was busy working on my Stigard Wilderness Center at that time, but I basically packed my bags and moved down here. I took up residence on my houseboat on the St. Paul Yacht Club there, and then started up the nonprofit and to do the climate work.
You know, Will, we are living in weird times these days, it seems. Yep. Like. There's positive progress on renewables, there's positive progress on corporate awareness, and then there's this sort of dark ages approach to climate change solutions in Washington, D.C. I feel like I ask this to everybody lately. What's your assessment of where we're at and where we're going?
Well, it's really crazy times, as we all know. It's too bad that the president is, dismantling our progress on clean energy, or at least trying, because we do employ millions of people in this sector right now, but I think it's an overreaction. I think there's going to be penalties to that, and it's definitely getting people that normally would not take action to take action, including a lot of businesses, corporations, and individuals. So there is a reaction, I've been around a block a few times here, and I've been through these where you're times when you're really discouraged, but a lot of people get taken down by the discouragement of the moment. But I always look a little bit more forward on it, and because I see this is it's not going to be, it might not even be this is happening. Depends on the election coming in, but I never thought I would see this, because I thought we were making progress on the understanding of what's going on, and I think we're all baffled by it, but. But I think it's important that we don't get taken down by the political energy, because then you're part of the problem. We really have to look at this constructively, and then move forward on that. And I hope that we do that. We collectively start moving. And after all, still a democracy, and we can vote. So let's get going and join us here on this climate issues that are so important.
You were at an event this week with filmmaker James Redford for his HBO film about renewables. We'll hear some of that conversation that I had with him in just a few minutes here on ClimateCast. But he said something that struck me, Will. Basically, he said, we don't need to talk about climate change when it comes to solutions. And now he's probably right about that. On one hand, that's a very smart take, but I also thought how absurd this whole resistance to climate solutions is. What's your view on the best way to create positive change?
Well, you know, what we're doing right now is you know, within the community, but I've always approached it economically, but through jobs, and which we are creating, because then you build a constituency. And we are going to have to adapt. I mean, changes are coming, and we have to look at that. But there are lots of solutions, and the solutions, fortunately, are economic. And by being economic, Lisa, I used to think that that would bridge the political divide. I think it will again someday. But I'm still very hopeful. I mean, I'm very positive, but I'm hopeful in the collective human spirit, and I think we'll overcome this. But we still have to adapt because the changes are coming, and the way we adapt is being more, in Minnesota here, more self-reliant and building up our clean energy economy, which employs our own people.
Which is happening pretty fast here in Minnesota. Yeah. At this event this week, you told me there was a lot of corporate support. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Climate Generation, we had a full event yesterday. Jamie Redford was our keynote. I spent the whole day with him. He's really a great man, totally committed to things we're talking about here. We had a luncheon with about 250 business people, individuals. It was a great event. And then afterwards, we had a forum, a business forum, with about 60 various companies and individuals. And it's amazing the corporations that are really, they've been on board a long time, but they just don't talk about it. And part of this is that we say, we've got to really, corporations got to start owning up that, hey, you know, they're already being self-sufficient and getting their, a lot of these companies are getting a lot of their electricity already from renewables. But it's very, it was my dream come true. I lobbied the senators and congresspeople in 2004, and they basically told me, hey, I can't get elected on climate issues. Come back when you have business on your side. And that's what we saw yesterday. And as some of you may know, Trump took us out of the Paris Climate Accord here. Oh, it was a year ago. But
yes,
this is a project Minnesota is still in, and Mark Dayton is committed, and that we're going to do this without the federal government. And you know, we can't rely on the federal government anyways too much anymore, but we are. Minnesota is doing it. It's a lead state, and we should be very proud. And collectively, we all should be working together on this.
Well, we've got about a minute left. Like many of us in Minnesota, Sigurd Olson is a revered figure for me, Listening Point, one of my favorite books. I know that you knew Sig, and Mike in Minneapolis wants to know, what do you think young people need to hear about people like Sigurd Olson?
Well, they probably need to hear and probably more so go outside and spend more time in the wilderness, ideally, you know, if you can do that and organize yourself and get your family organized. But we need to be outdoors, of course, more. And I think there's a spiritual need there among the youth now to work with their hands, to be outdoors. I mean, I think it's a void there that is just waiting to be filled. And we have to connect our younger kids to the out-of-doors. And that can be anything to our city parks, to a trip down the Minnehaha or whatever it might be. But it's very, very important to get away a little bit from the computer screen and see the other side, because it's through the connection with nature is where, you see progress made.
Quick 20 seconds left. You're headed up to Ely tomorrow. What's next for you this summer?
Yeah, I'm working on the Stigler Wilderness Center there, a convening center, and we're working with Summit Academy on the north side right now. So we're building up a huge program around retooling the skill-based economy that's coming up. I mean, there's a real demand here for skilled jobs and around renewables and everything, and so I want to be part of that, so we're doing that right now.
Wilderness explorer Will Steger, welcome home to Minnesota, and thanks for your perspective today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Paul. I appreciate it.
Support comes from Half Price Books. encouraging fun summer reading for kids preschool to high school with the Feed Your Brain Summer Reading Program. Information at neighborhood stores and at hpb.com. Support comes from Hamlin School of Education, preparing teachers who want to teach for a changing world by leading classrooms and communities that are sustainable, innovative, and resilient. Find out how you can become a teacher at hamlin.edu/teach.
Welcome back to ClimateCast, everybody. I'm Paul Huttner. The truth about climate change? It's a big, complicated planet. We're still learning about the complex interactions and connections between different parts of our atmosphere. Recently, I spoke with Dr. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University. She studies the links between changes in the Arctic and changes in the jet stream over us. And she's finding clear fingerprints that suggest climate changes in the Arctic are changing our weather here in the U.S. She told me the changes are occurring in the Arctic, and they're happening much faster than anybody expected.
You know, we're seeing the sea ice disappear on the Arctic Ocean. This is the ice that floats and forms on the Arctic Ocean in the last 40 years, which is really not very long. We've seen half of that ice cover disappear. So that would be in the summers. And then if you take into account the thickness of that ice as well and calculate the volume, we've seen 3/4 of that ice volume disappear in only 40 years. It's just a remarkably rapid change with huge implications for biology, for local people, for shipping, for commercial interests, and also for weather and sea level rise. So there's a lot of things that ice loss has to do with the climate system.
Now, I think the going assessment was that the Arctic would be ice-free by around 2100, but you wrote a piece in Scientific American recently, which I very much enjoyed. You didn't mince any words. You're talking about perhaps the Arctic ice-free by as early as 2040?
That's what most of the really good climate models are suggesting. It actually could happen any summer now, but I think the consensus of the best models is that it will probably happen somewhere between 2020 and 2040. And when we say an ice-free summer, it doesn't mean that every little speck of ice is going to be gone. It means that there'll still be what we call a refuge of ice just north of the Canadian islands, near Greenland in that area where it's still very thick. But essentially, for all practical purposes, the Arctic summer ice is going to be pretty much gone very soon.
Let's talk about the sensitivity of ice to climate. We have a local researcher here, Dr. Jay Austin, with the Large Lakes Observatory at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and they found that just a 2 degrees Celsius average temperature difference in winter is all it takes to go from totally ice-covered on Superior to little or no ice. Are we seeing that same sensitivity in the Arctic?
We're actually seeing more sensitivity in the Arctic. And the reason is that there are several of these vicious cycles that happen together with different kinds of ice, the characteristics of the atmosphere, that whenever you get a warming happening for whatever reason, that warming is amplified. And so what we're seeing as a result is that the Arctic is warming 2 to 3 times faster than just about everywhere else on the planet. And it's because of these vicious cycles that kick in related to ice loss. So the easiest one to explain and think about is if you lose some of the ice, which of course is very white and bright, and when sunshine hits that bright ice, it gets reflected right back to outer space and never enters the climate system. However, if you lose some of that ice and you instead have this very dark ocean exposed to that sunshine then just gets absorbed into the water. It warms that water and it melts even more ice. And so it sets up this, as I said, a vicious cycle, or what's known as a positive feedback. And this is just one example of several that are creating this, what we call Arctic amplification, or the amplified warming that we're seeing happening in the Arctic.
And let's talk about the atmosphere now, because this is your area of specialty. Your work has taught many of us a lot about how the Arctic is connected to the jet stream, weather patterns here in the mid-latitudes. What's the latest science on that connection showing?
Well, there's been a whole lot of science going on. It's a really rapidly evolving scientific research topic. A lot of people are working on it all over the world, and it's really hard to keep up with it all, actually. And the more we dig into it, of course, the more complicated it is. We see different connections and mechanisms happening in different locations, in different seasons, and with different natural background changes. So let me give an example of one of the really interesting new things that we think is happening. So we know that there are natural fluctuations in the temperature patterns in the Pacific Ocean, for example. So one of these happens, you know, roughly every 10 years or so, where sometimes we see a lot of warm water piled up along the west coast of North America. And sometimes that water is colder than average. So a few years ago, that fluctuation flipped to having a lot of warm water all along the west coast of North America. When that happens, we tend to see a pattern in the jet stream where it takes one of these northward swings, and that tends to happen where that warm water sits. So if you take that as the background, and then you also combine with that a lot of ice lost in the Pacific side of the Arctic Ocean. So here we have, as I was explaining, how when the ice disappears, you get a lot more energy going into the ocean there. It warms up that water. So if we get that happening in combination with this ocean temperature pattern, we get an intensification of this big northward swing in the jet stream.
Which we might, some have called the ridiculously resilient
that
ridge over the west coast.
That has been called the ridiculously.
Tied to the California drought.
Exactly.
And the bigger picture, we're talking about Pacific decadal oscillation, right?
That's
that
exactly
long-term
right.
change.
That's exactly right. So when we get that ridge becoming really intense because of this combined effect, one being natural fluctuation, the other being this climate change-related change in the ice cover and the warming in the Arctic, then that big ridge tends to be much more persistent. And as a result, we see this tendency for, you know, very long-term drought happening in the West. And the couple to that downstream is you get the sort of the rebound effect, which is when the jet stream takes a big southward dip. And that, during the winter time, is what's been allowing all that cold air to come down over Minnesota and my area in New England. And, you know, everybody whining about the storminess and the cold and even into April.
Right. And we've discussed that as an analogy where you might say it's like leaving the freezer door open in the Arctic. That's a hard one to explain to people, right? Because we're looking at a warmer Arctic. We're looking at a warmer planet. We're seeing these changes, and yet it's displacing this cold air from the Arctic over the eastern half of North America. So we're getting these cold winters, or at least last year was a good example. And people are saying, well, how do we tie that to climate change? And you just explained it. That's pretty great.
Well, there's definitely an explanation there. And for, you know, anybody who wants to jump out on the Senate floor and throw a snowball and say that climate change is a hoax because look how cold and snowy it is outside, we can make that connection now.
Yeah. Let's talk about waves in the jet stream. I know this is something you work on. It's something I deal with every day as a daily weather practitioner, right? Slower, wavier jet stream equals more weather extremes. We've talked about that. Stronger storms, potentially capable of heavier rainfall, faster and more intense droughts under these persistent ridges like you described. What does the most recent data show about these trends? Is this continuing and amplifying as the Arctic changes?
Well, we think so. It's, you know, as you know, it's an incredibly chaotic system. Weather changes a lot, and we have a very short record to deal with in terms of the real world, because it's really only been since the mid to late 1990s where we've seen this incredibly rapid warming in the Arctic really kick in. So that said, there's been a ton of research and coming up with some very creative new ways to measure some of these expected shifts. The other way that people are attacking this problem is, of course, with climate models, these very sophisticated computer simulations that try to capture all the different physical processes that happen in the climate system. And by using those, we can start to do experiments in the computer world where, you know, we lose a lot of ice in the Arctic and how does the atmosphere respond, but you keep everything else the same. So it helps you kind of isolate the effect of the Arctic. And we are seeing some not all studies, but many studies are starting to show that we are seeing a tendency for this strong ridge in the west in North America and strong trough or the southward dip in the east as a prevalent pattern under these conditions.
Let's go back in time a little bit. 25,000 years ago, when the Arctic was this warm, oceans were, what, 13 to 20 feet higher.
So 125,000 years ago.
I'm sorry, yes, 125,000 years ago. Could we be at the beginning of that kind of a rapid sea level rise, or is that just an unknown for us how quickly the ice is going to respond to these dramatic climate shift in the Arctic?
Yeah, so we are definitely seeing an acceleration in the rise of sea levels. We know that's tied to the accelerated melt of the land ice. So this is a different kind of ice now we're talking about.
Yes.
So things like glaciers,
Greenland
ice sheet, and we have to also bring Antarctic ice sheet into this as well. So we know that that melting is going faster in those ice sheets. It's really hard to measure how fast it's happening because some of it is happening underneath in the ocean where the ice meets the ocean. That's a very hard place to measure. But it's clear that we are definitely looking at an increase in the pace of sea level rise, and we know that's tied to the ice sheets.
What's the big picture message when you talk to people that you want them to know about your work in the Arctic?
So what I want people to know about what's going on in the Arctic is that we know what's changing in the Arctic. We know how fast that's changing. And we know what's changing it. So it is one of the clearest signs of human-caused climate change that we can imagine. And you can look, you could take maps of sea ice change, show them to a sixth grader or a second grader, and they will go, oh my goodness, that is a huge change, because it is. It's so big that anybody can see it. And we also know that there are many ways that what's changing in the Arctic is affecting all of us down here. So we've talked about sea level rise as one of those. We've talked about the effects on weather patterns. But there's also huge effects on the biological systems of especially the ocean. And those are probably some of our biggest unknowns and potential wild cards. We didn't really have a good grasp of what the biology under the ice was like before. And now that it's being exposed to this huge change, it's even harder to understand how all these things are connected to each other. So it's going to affect fisheries, and those in turn will affect a lot of communities that depend on fisheries near the Arctic as we watch that food web up there shift in dramatic ways.
As I've sometimes said and heard, the Arctic is not like Vegas, right? What happens in the Arctic doesn't necessarily stay in the Arctic.
That's exactly right. And we're finding that is the case on a number of things. You know, it used to be really just the sea level rise story, but now we're finding that there's many, many other ways that what's happening in the Arctic is affecting us all.
Great stuff. Jennifer Francis with Rutgers University, thanks so much for your work and your perspective.
My pleasure. Anytime.
My name is Mark Grimes, and I live in St. Anthony Village.
And my name is Tricia Grimes, and I live in the same place. Well, we have solar panels on our house. We've had them for 2.5 years now. So it cost about $30,000 up front to get the solar panels put on our house. We have 20 solar panels, and it was designed to produce enough electricity to meet all of our needs. And we then got a $9,000 tax credit from the federal government the first year. And then we are in the Made in Minnesota program, so we're getting paid 37 cents a kilowatt hour for each kilowatt that we generate. And so in the 2.5 years, we've made about $4,800 from that. And then we save $50 a month on our electricity. So altogether, we've saved over $15,000 already of the $30,000 that we invested originally.
It's been pretty exciting. People really are excited about it. They walk down the street. And actually, there are 3 families now on our street alone that have solar panels.
But we were the first ones.
The other folks, they saw us and it made sense to them.
And we had to get the city to change the ordinance, because in their sustainability plan, they wanted to encourage solar panels, but they hadn't yet changed the ordinance to allow residences to have solar panels on their roofs. So they did change that just in time for us to get our panels put on.
It wasn't that difficult, and it was part of their comprehensive plan to be sustainable, but they just hadn't thought of it because it was something that went on the roof and it was, you know, went above the roof, and that wasn't exactly permitted by code. And I think many cities now have changed so that they permit the solar panels on roofs. I just think for a couple of reasons, it just seems to make economic sense. It doesn't, I mean, it's, you're saving money. You know, we figure it's about a 6-year payback on this system. It's kind of a no-brainer. I'm not an economist or, you know, smart in that kind of stuff, but 6 years is pretty fast. After 6 years, we're creating all our energy and not having to pay an XL bill. And I think that's, you know, it's pretty exciting. And I just think it shows that we can do it, anybody else can do it.
Now, we're not perfect. We still fly places, and that uses a lot of carbon when you fly somewhere. But we try to live gently on the earth to the extent we can otherwise. And we really enjoy things like being able to show people the app on our phone that shows how much solar power we're generating each day. We just really enjoy the idea that, you know, a bright sunny day is also producing a heck of a lot of solar power with our house.
Well, that's just about the best thing I've heard this week. Real people taking action on climate change on their own terms. I'm Paul Huttner. You're listening to a special live one-hour edition of ClimateCast. Speaking of solar energy, it's one piece of this renewable energy revolution that's sweeping the country. That phenomenon is highlighted in a new film called Happening, A Clean Energy Revolution. Listen to this scene from deep in the heart of Texas.
You know, when you think of Texas, you think of oil derricks, you think of gas. And so here's this little city that goes 100% green. We're the second city in the country to go 100% green. Burlington, Vermont was the first. Our duty to our ratepayers is to provide the lowest cost energy. When we compared wind and solar to natural gas, wind and solar was about equal. But the providers would give us guaranteed contracts for 25 years on wind and solar, and natural gas providers was only for 6 years. So that made it, the decision pretty easy.
Do people see solar and wind as, oh no, it's going to ruin our way of life and our legacy and our history? Or do they just say, hey man, more energy?
When you do something new and different, if it involves change, I think some people get concerned. They just want to make sure that it works and it doesn't impact them negatively. And in the job markets, we're still doing tons of oil and gas in Texas.
Right.
We can just use it for other sources other than make electricity.
The gentleman you heard asking the questions in that clip was James Redford, and he was in town this week. Yes, that Redford. He told me the disconnect between climate change and booming renewable energy economy is what inspired him to make the film.
The fact is that, you know, the amount of job growth in the clean energy sector is huge. If you include efficiencies, you're talking about close to 3 million people. Which is three times as many people that work in fossil fuels. So it's massive and it's growing. And guess what? The jobs are growing in places that have been traditionally more conservative and more fossil fuel friendly. So I see a real disruption coming because in the end, people are going to go where the money is and where the jobs are. So I see that happening everywhere. And people are beginning to understand, look, if you're in communities that don't want to talk about climate change and climate science, then don't talk about it. You don't have to. If you want to push renewables.
So I noticed in the film, climate change, the renewable energy boom, it's making for some strange bedfellows. And you found some people who crossed some unusual political lines, shall we say. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The reality is that renewable energy is not a political issue in many places. It's an economic issue. And it's a strategic issue with the U.S. Navy embracing renewable energy because it presents, frankly, battlefield advantages and massive efficiencies for them to go renewable. But then you also have mayors of small towns that realize, wait a minute, I can lock in a renewable energy rate for 20 years and not be worried about fossil fuels and how they go up and down. So there's all these motivations to get behind renewable energy that actually unite us in a way that we're not acknowledging right now.
And, you know, it seems to me this is as much a technological progress as anything else, as it is political will. And you describe this renewable energy boom as, quote, a profound economic and cultural revolution. We agree with that. I agree with that assessment here on ClimateCast, but it seems like we still have a long way to go. Why are you so optimistic?
Well, I'm optimistic because I'm seeing that the inevitability is there. Market forces will get us there. Am I optimistic that we're going to get it there as quickly as possible? Not necessarily. And I think that's where the real work is. It's not about whether or not this country is going to be running mostly on renewables in 30 to 50 years, which it will. It's about if we know that's inevitable and we know the technologies we have today can get us there, why aren't we accelerating that? We haven't really done very much. I mean, we still have $27 billion a year in fossil fuel subsidies, and yet we're not doing nearly as much for renewables. So if you, by the way, worry about climate change, then it really wouldn't take much to accelerate this inevitability. And we should be doing that.
You know, I look at that and I see maybe there's really an economic war still going on here between those legacy fuels like coal, oil, natural gas, and renewables. Did your film deal with that at all?
Well, yes, because, you know, and unexpectedly so. You know, I stumbled on a situation in Nevada in which the Utilities Commission there at 5 p.m. on December 31st of 2015 decided to change the agreement they had with homeowners who had solar panels. They made it more expensive for them to participate in the grid, and they made it less profitable for them to sell their clean energy. And in one fell swoop, suddenly you had 30,000 solar homes in Nevada that saw their economic equation change. And so, and that was all the doings of, you know, the inner circle of the energy monopoly in Nevada. And luckily, they really overstepped, and the citizens made a lot of noise. And when the legislation came back a year and a half later, they turned all that around.
James, we think about how people think about climate change. George Mason, among other places, Yale, have done studies that say there are basically six Americas on climate change opinion. And I'm of the opinion that about 10% of those Americans we call dismissives on climate change will never be convinced. And we really don't have to do that to make progress. But what do you think the best approach to convince the 20 to 30% or so of open-minded but still reluctant people that renewable energy is in their economic self-interest and will also help conserve the planet?
Well, for the time being, you know, I really do think you're best off presenting all of the other arguments aside from climate change. And then if you want to drop that in as a little cherry on top at the end, no harm done perhaps, you know. But I think there's so many other reasons to do this, largely just economically. People are going to find we already know that generating electricity through wind is cheaper than coal, and now it's approaching to surpassing natural gas as well. And we're just getting going. So economics are going to be the most powerful thing. But beyond that, you know, fossil fuels, if we didn't have climate change, sometimes I wonder if we would be making more progress. Because if we were just looking at the specifics of fossil fuels and how bad they are for our communities, particularly our distressed communities, where, you know, very often the refineries are, it's where do the coal trains go when they come into town uncovered. You know, there are so many other reasons, and auto pollutions, and who's next to our massive freeways, who's paying the price of that. Those issues alone should be encouraging us to get away from fossil fuels. So, you know, you can always talk about those things as well.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your father, actor Robert Redford. What's his view about climate issues, and did the two of you talk about your film?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I was 23-year-old grad student at Northwestern when my dad invited me to go to Moscow to sit in on a conference he was going to about something called the greenhouse effect. And frankly, I went there that day and saw Soviet and American scientists exchanging good science about this and showing great concern. And I was, at that age, more interested in getting back out on the streets than sitting in that conference. But, you know, what I'm talking about, I'm 56 now, and that was over 30 years ago. And so this has been present in my life, in my household for many generations. And my parents advocated for solar energy back when it was ridiculously expensive, just on moral grounds. So, you know, this has always been around, but really this journey of my own the last 3 or 4 years has been the true education.
Elevator speech for what you do and how you view renewable energy when you meet somebody on the street or at a cafe. What's your message?
Do you realize that Apple is 100% renewable? I mean, you know, the corporate aspect of this really charges people, particularly, you know, when they think about the products they use. And So, you know, if I really want to get someone's attention, I'll say something like that. But, you know, I make stories that are meant to be used as helpful tools and clear up confusing things or if you have misconceptions. And so telling these stories cleanly and simply is what drives me. And I think this is one of those areas where some straight ahead storytelling can really help the average American who's busy. They have other things to worry about. So we're hopeful this will help.
Well, and you do it well. The film from HBO is Happening, A Clean Revolution. Filmmaker James Redford, thank you for your work and for your insight today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Finally this week, Arizona, here we come. A study in the journal Nature Climate Change predicts that 13 million Americans could lose their homes from climate change by 2100. Florida could lose more than 2 million people, with Louisiana and New Jersey losing close to a 500,000 each. And places like Phoenix and Tucson, Arizona, are expected to gain more than 100,000 climate refugees. But one big factor that may limit migration to the Southwest? Water. The Colorado River is already stressed, and climate change will likely limit the amount of water available to support additional residents. Minnesota is expected to gain a much smaller number of climate change refugees. The number one destination for climate change movers? Austin, Texas, with an expected 800,000 new residents. With millions of Americans likely on the move in the next 80 years because of climate change, maybe those Minnesota winters aren't looking so bad after all. That's ClimateCast this week. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.